Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the much-anticipated report from the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, Michael Horowitz, which finds the FBI had sufficient reason to open an investigation of the Trump campaign's ties to Russia in 2016, while it had some criticism for the last of a number of FISA applications to surveil the Trump campaign's National Security Advisor, Carter Page, who was caught by the FBI being recruited by two Russian intelligence agents who were later kicked out of the country. Asha Rangappa, Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and was an FBI counterintelligence investigator, and is now a legal and national security analyst at CNN, joins us. We will discuss the report, which refutes Trump's deep state conspiracies and attacks on the FBI that they were a bunch of Democratic operatives who conspired to sabotage his campaign. Although the report exonerates the FBI and justifies the Russian probe, Attorney General Barr has again come to Trump's defense, claiming the report, quote, makes clear that the FBI launched an intrusive investigation, while Barr's handpicked federal prosecutor John Durham, who is investigating the origins of the Russia investigation, chimed in that, quote, we do not agree with some of the report's conclusions as to predication and how the FBI case was opened. Then we'll look further into the report with Kenneth McCallion, a former Assistant Attorney General with the U.S. Department of Justice, who worked on numerous sensitive counterintelligence investigations involving Russian espionage in the United States. The author of the new book Treason and Betrayal, The Rise and Fall of Individual One, he joins us to discuss the futility of trying to convince the one-third of the country who are Trump's base and to concentrate on educating the two-thirds about the criminality and treachery of our president. Then finally, we'll assess the report obtained by the Washington Post after a three-year legal battle called the Lessons Learned Project by the Office of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, which found that after $1 trillion wasted along with the lives of U.S. servicemen and women, there has been little to no progress made, and that the American public has been continuously lied to and misled during our 18 years at war. A leading expert on Afghanistan, Thomas Barfield, the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, joins us to discuss this report, which is being compared to the Pentagon Papers of the 1970s. And joining us now is Asha Rangappa, who's a senior lecturer at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. She previously served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City, is now a legal and national security analyst at CNN. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asha Rangappa.
Hi.
So, Asha, I know you've had a busy day with this report coming out, but as a former member of the FBI, do you feel exonerated even though we live in a divided country with alternative realities?
Well, I think that the major charges that were levied against the FBI, that this was a politically motivated investigation that was intended to bring down President Trump, and that there, you know, was illegal wiretapping and all of that, has been vindicated by the IG report, which found that there was no political bias and that the investigation itself was properly predicated. The IG, of course, did find some problems, and I think that those warrant attention and further, you know, reforms possibly of how some of the processes work.
But the fault was found in, I think, the fourth or fifth FISA application on Carter Page, who was then the national security advisor to Donald Trump's campaign. He had been recruited by two Russian intelligence officers, and they were subsequently booted out of the country. You worked in counterintelligence against the Russians. My God, I mean, isn't that a pretty serious situation? Even if they made some clerical errors or didn't cross the T's and dot the I's, isn't there reasonable suspicion to be looking into Carter Page since he'd been recruited by the Russians?
Well, I think that the IG report did uncover some issues there, and namely that there was information that the FBI had that might have undercut some of their probable cause. Now, the FISA order may have issued regardless. But for example, some of his contacts with foreign intelligence officers in Russia which formed a part of the probable cause, it looks like some of those contacts might have been at the request of another U.S. government agency. To me, it seems like possibly the CIA. So, you know, that's a big problem. It doesn't mean, you know, without reading the entire application, it's hard to see how material those kinds of, you know, mistakes or omissions were. But I think that overall, it does suggest that, you know, there were some procedures that, you know, where things fell through the cracks. And I think that warrants a further look, but it does not discredit the entire investigation into the Russian contacts with the Trump campaign generally, which included a number of other individuals besides Carter Page, including Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn, both of whom are, well, Michael Flynn is now awaiting sentencing, and Paul Manafort, who is also in jail.
So what do you make then of William Barr, who's again come to Trump's rescue, saying in refuting this report, saying the Inspector General's report now makes clear that the FBI launched an intrusive investigation of a U.S. presidential campaign? I mean, aren't investigations by nature intrusive? What's he saying there?
Yeah, that was a very bizarre statement by Barr. I think it's, again, another attempt for him to try to spin it. You know, whether the investigation had a legitimate basis is determined on factual evidence and whether it met the standard for opening an investigation. And the IG found that it did. And specifically that there was evidence that, you know, based on the FBI's knowledge that the Russians had hacked the DNC server and were possibly working with WikiLeaks to release it and then were approaching the campaign offering assistance, that they had an obligation to investigate it. So it's really not about about Barr's personal views. As you said, investigations are by their nature intrusive. You know, this one technique, the FISA order, it was one small part of a larger overall investigation. I suspect what he's going to try to do is conflate the two.
And again, I'm speaking with Asha Rangappa, who's a senior lecturer at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. She's previously served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City, and is now a legal and national security analyst at CNN. So in terms of this narrative that Donald Trump has developed along, and there's been a sort of echo chamber through Fox News and other conservative media, that had ginned up this idea that there is a deep state and that the FBI, if you follow the logic or the lack of logic, are a bunch of Democratic operatives conspiring to sabotage Trump's presidency. I've talked to a few people in the FBI and they say, you know, it's not exactly a liberal organization. If you poll the place, probably a lot of, maybe even a majority of FBI agents voted for Trump. So do you think it's...
Yeah, I mean, look, the IG categorically states that in all aspects of what he investigated, he did not find any evidence of political bias or motivation. And in fact, there is a portion of the report in a footnote which details text exchanges by agents that were celebrating the election of Donald Trump. So, you know, if anything, there were agents that were expressing their support for Donald Trump. And another interesting piece that comes out in the report is that Christopher Steele himself had a favorable view of Trump and, in fact, contacts with Ivanka Trump in the years leading up to this investigation and knew her for a long time. So, you know, I think that the deep state conspiracy is really put to rest with this report.
Well, it certainly has been put to rest sometime in my mind and probably yours, but how do you deal with his supporters? Does this kind of evidence work? I mean, particularly when you've got William Barr trying to contradict it without offering any substantive reasons why there's anything wrong in it. And also John Durham, the special investigator, special prosecutor that Barr has hired to or appointed to look into the origins of the FBI's Russia probe. He's also has quibbles with it, but they're not really saying what the problems are. Do you understand whether they're going to come up with anything, or is this just trying to keep this alternative narrative alive. And I suspect, in spite of the evidence in this report, it will be kept alive.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's what they have going for them at this point, is to try to keep, you know, the separate factual reality in existence. I was very surprised that John Durham, who has a very good reputation in the Department of Justice, chose to comment on the IG report, given that he is conducting a separate ongoing investigation. So it's really not good form for him to be commenting on those conclusions or to say that he disagrees with that without actually producing anything to substantiate that. So, you know, ultimately, you know, I think that the sad part is that this is really undermining people's faith in the legitimacy of the rule of law overall. And that's not a good thing for the United States, because the rule of law is basically the pillar on which our country is based.
Well, but the number one lawman is the Attorney General, is he not? So that should be his first priority.
Absolutely. And I think that that's been more than President Trump. Bill Barr has really been a huge driver in, I think, undermining the legitimacy of our institutions.
So how do you think this report will impact the other, I was going to say circus, but perhaps I shouldn't say that, the other big investigation going on today with the impeachment hearings, which were extremely faction-driven today? Is there any way that this might impact the proceedings that are leading in the House towards impeachment and, of course, later, sometime in January, a trial in the Senate?
I don't think so. I think Speaker Pelosi was very astute in actually waiting for a situation to arise that was pretty much separate from anything that was investigated as a part of the Russian interference situation. So I think that the impeachment proceedings will largely proceed with, you know, and that this won't impact it. But as you said, it does further a narrative that's been in existence that then helps people discount any kind of allegations made against Trump, even if they're unrelated.
So when you mentioned earlier about Carter Page, that perhaps, and I know he went to Russia, is it possible then that the CIA recruited him and or turned him or made him into a double agent? Because I thought he'd affected, according to intercepts of these two Russian intelligence officers who were recruiting him, were also talking to Moscow Center about what a greedy SOB he was and how they really didn't like him, which I guess has nothing to do with, you know, whether you recruit somebody or not. But so is.
I can't speculate on what the CIA may have done. All I can say is that the IG report suggests that he was engaging in some kind of operational activity for another agency.
But another U.S. agency, right?
Correct. Yes, another U.S. agency. Exactly.
Right. He wasn't a triple agent. In other words.
Right.
So, and Steele, of course, he was apparently told, his people were told, with very little notice, that confidential information about him would be appearing in this report. I know Steele's company, Orbis, has done very well, so he hasn't suffered financially, even though he's been excoriated by the Republicans. But what's your understanding about whether or not there's any damaging stuff? I don't see how damaging it is that he voted for Trump or that he had a prior, I guess, business relationship or an email relationship with Ivanka Trump.
I don't know how it will affect him. I mean, I really don't know. I don't know much about his business relationships or anything like that.
Well, he supposedly made about $50 million worth of contracts. That's what I've been told. But I mean, you know, it doesn't hurt to have your name bandied about. What do they say? There's no such thing as bad publicity.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. So just in the last minute or so then, what's your sense of this report in terms of rank and file? What are you hearing from your fellow former and perhaps even current FBI agents?
I think largely, you know, it's vindicating, as I said at the beginning. I mean, you know, this was a legitimate investigation. It was something that the FBI needed to look into. They did. It was ultimately taken over by the special counsel, Robert Mueller, who is, you know, an independent entity. He was not, you know, involved with the Obama administration or whatever. And we've seen the results in the indictments of various Russians, of, you know, Michael Flynn, of Paul Manafort. So I think the results really speak for themselves.
And just in closing, today, of course, Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, is meeting with Putin to try and make a deal to end this war that Russia is prosecuting against his country, having seized Crimea. Just in the broader sense, he seems very vulnerable. The Ukrainian people are worried. They've demonstrated on Sunday in Maidan, the Independence Square, saying, you know, please don't sell us out to the Russians, because he's been undercut by the Trump administration. So at the end of the day, do you think the broader national security implications of Trump's behavior will be made clear?
I hope so. I think some of that was made clear in the impeachment hearings today. And, you know, I think that ultimately looking at Trump's actions as ones that benefit Russia and that are not in the national security interests of the United States is kind of the bottom line that people need to focus on.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Asha Rangappa.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Asha Rangappa, who's a senior lecturer at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. Previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigation in New York City, and is now a legal and national security analyst at CNN. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world. But the Murphy family is my boss. The voters of the world keep supporting me. And I promise to take you very far. Other mothers better not upset me. Or I'll send a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me to win, I sincerely like to thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kenneth McCallion, who's a former Special Assistant Attorney General in the United States Department of Justice and a nationally recognized expert on constitutional law, especially the impeachment clause, who has significant experience in the fields of civil RICO, criminal law, and the history of treason and espionage in the United States. He spent the early part of his law career working as a federal prosecutor with the U.S. Department of Justice, handling high-profile organized crime prosecutions and working on major labor racketeering cases, including some investigations that dealt with the construction of Trump Tower. He also worked on numerous sensitive counterintelligence investigations involving Russian espionage in the United States, involving coordination between and among U.S. Department of Justice and FBI agents with the CIA, the U.S. Department of State, and he's the author of Treason and Betrayal, The Rise and Fall of Individual One. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth McCallion.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ken. And what did you make of the much-anticipated release today of the Inspector General of the Department of Justice's report on the FBI's handling of the investigation into Trump's campaigns and its ties to Russia?
There really weren't many surprises in that it had been anticipated and consistent with really prior investigations of the origins of the 2016 investigation of Russian hacking and interference with the 2016 election, that there was a sound factual basis for the FBI to commence the investigation. And actually, conversely, if they did not, they would be remiss in conducting their job properly if they had not commenced an investigation, given the fact that there were substantial indications and evidence of Russian hacking and interference as of that point.
So the 434-page report from the DOJ's Inspector General Michael Horowitz basically found that the FBI did in fact have an authorized purpose when it initiated its investigation known as Crossfire Hurricane, and that Mr. Horowitz concluded that the FBI had sufficient evidence in July of 2016 to lawfully open the investigation and use informants. It certainly demolishes a lot of the rhetoric we've been getting, particularly from President Trump, and the way that he has focused on Peter Strzok and Lisa Page and Andrew McCabe. They come out of it pretty unscathed, and said, the report says neither Lisa Page nor Peter Strzok played a determinative role in Operation Crossfire Hurricane. But nevertheless, you know, in this bizarre world, in our divided country, you've got people on the right like Mark Meadows, an aggressive apologist for Trump, saying this is not a good day for the FBI. There's more than enough evidence in this report that could suggest a major overhaul in terms of policies and procedures. So do you think they've done any, I mean, they've obviously done a lot of damage to the FBI, the Trump administration, but is there any substance to this kind of rhetoric, or does it matter to the people that in the Trump world that have already made up their minds and will just continue to push this narrative? In other words, do you see this as clearing the air or just another case where the Republicans have their version of reality and the Democrats keep pointing to the report, but nobody's actually listening?
Well, I think you're correct that each side looks at it through its own lens. I think objectively looking at it, you have about 98% of the report is generally exculpatory and, in fact, laudatory regarding the FBI's investigation. And obviously, I think objective observers and certainly Democrats are going to look at that 98%. The other 2% does contain some critique of at least one FBI agent of going a bit overboard in collecting information and perhaps manufacturing it, certainly spinning it with regard to one FISA application. And it does suggest that there should be a closer look, which it looks like Attorney General Barr is going to direct that it be conducted, a closer look at the FBI and Department of Justice's development of FISA wiretap applications. And actually, it's a complex area and a very sensitive area. And quite frankly, I think that periodically, certainly every 5-10 years, those procedures should be properly examined again, given the fact that these FISA, warrant courts are conducted in secret proceedings and put a tremendous burden on the FBI and Department of Justice to follow the most rigorous and objective, fair approach to presenting these FISA applications to the FISA courts. So, yes, an investigation and a review of procedures is certainly warranted, but that does not detract from the fact that of the basic finding that there was significant and indeed overwhelming evidence that Russia was using cutouts and very aggressive techniques to hack DNC servers to influence the 2016 election, and that's the basic thrust of the report.
Well, the criticism of the FBI agent was, I think, maybe it was the fourth or the fifth FISA application to put Carter Page under surveillance, but the original FBI FISA applications, which judges certainly signed off on, were based on very solid evidence from intercepts that the couple of Russian spies who were subsequently booted out of this country were trying to recruit him. I mean, that's the FBI's job, for God's sake.
No, absolutely. And indeed, they did recruit him. And the FBI was able to obtain the tapes. They were able to obtain the surveillance and develop a case against the two Russian agents who were using Page as kind of a useful, willing idiot.
Right, and when
to collect evidence.
Sure, and when Trump was asked early in the campaign about who is his foreign policy advisors, who does he name but Carter Page? I mean, the guy was...
Oh, absolutely.
It's just...
A picture is worth a thousand words, and with Carter Page sitting around the table with Trump
right.
as part of his national security team speaks volumes.
Right, and he's a recruited spy for the SVR, the Russian Foreign Intelligence. So even though, you know, Senator Blumenthal is basically saying that the report from the IG of the DOJ completely demolishes these conservative assertions and talking points, nevertheless, the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, says the Inspector General report now makes it clear that the FBI launched an intrusive investigation of a U.S. presidential campaign on the thinnest of suspicions that, in my view, were insufficient to justify the steps taken. And John Durham, the special federal prosecutor that Barr's appointed to run his separate investigation into the origins of the Russian investigation, has backed up Barr with this statement, quote, "Last month we advised the Inspector General that we do not agree with some of the report's conclusions as to predication and how the FBI case was opened." So what do you think? I mean, these guys have, it happens with everybody, you know, in journalism, people buy into a story and they just, when they get it wrong, they can't admit they get it wrong. I understand that. But what's going on with Barr and Durham? People expect more of Durham and less of Barr. But what do you make of their continuing denial in spite of the findings of this IG's report?
Well, unfortunately, we come to expect this of Bill Barr, the Attorney General. He did it with a special counsel. Mueller's report obviously held off publication of that and spun a several-page summary, which completely distorted the findings of the Mueller report. So it's not surprising he's become, unfortunately, a really totally political animal. However, it's much more disturbing in the case of John Durham, who is conducting a criminal investigation, why he is opining on this particular report and weighing in with an opinion on it is really beyond me and really beyond the pale, since his investigation is still ongoing. Presumably there are grand juries involved, and yet he has not completed that process. And so to issue a off-the-cuff support of Barr and enter this political arena is very disturbing and I think counterproductive and unfortunately will lead him down a slippery slope of political involvement rather than professional law enforcement investigative work, which he's particularly known for.
Well, Horowitz, the IG of the DOJ, is scheduled to discuss the report Wednesday in public hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired, of course, by Lindsey Graham, big apologist for Trump. So I'm not sure what will come out of that. And again, we'll probably be dealing with the different realities from the Democrats in support of what the report finds and the Republicans still clinging to their alternative reality theories. Of course, Trump has been building this thing up. This is going to be greater than Watergate and all this stuff. This will be the big story, but it clearly hasn't been. Is there any way that Trump has egg on his face, or does his base just believe what he said, and even though the report doesn't say what Trump says, they will still see it as a great scandal, greater than Watergate?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, neither I nor I think most of the rest of the country can test reality by what Trump's base will believe. They'll believe whatever Trump tells them. to believe, unfortunately, and it's a parallel universe outside objective reality. The good news is that they're about one-third of the country, so I think that while I would like to think that objective persuasion could be applied to that one-third, I think we really have to concentrate on the other two-thirds of the country that may be amenable to rational and reasoned discourse and a factual examination of what the IG's report shows and the conclusions it has reached. So I think, assuming there's maybe 10% of persuadable or swing voters or members of the public out there, I think that the function of a free press and the hearings, the impeachment hearings in Congress, are most specifically directed to those rational persuadables who are open to reasoned discourse on this, both on issues relating to the origins of the FBI investigation as well as issues relating to the current impeachment of the president.
Well, just in closing, Ken McCallion, your new book, Treason and Betrayal, The Rise and Fall of Individual One, makes it clear case that not only does Donald Trump have a long history as a career criminal laundering dirty Russian money from Brighton Beach mobsters through Trump properties, 3,300 condos were bought by the Russians through these shell companies. Through Trump Towers, there were also a lot of money was laundered by the Russians through Trump's casinos in Atlantic City. You, early when they were building Trump Tower, prosecuted a labor racketeering case involving the construction of Trump Tower, where the teamster in charge, obviously connected to the mob lawyer, Trump's mentor, Roy Cohn, he had a condo in Trump Tower built specially for his mistress, who demanded a swimming pool high up in the top, so they had to do special renovations of the building to accommodate the swimming pool for the Teamster crook's mistress. So Trump is just so mobbed up, and my understanding is that's why he's terrified of this, the tax returns, which are now before the Supreme Court, being revealed, because they reveal laundering Russian money through Deutsche Bank. But he's also terrified of the IC reports, the CI reports, the counterintelligence reports, particularly the one that apparently was begun by the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, when Trump fired Comey. Barr, I take it, has squelched that report. Do you agree with my thesis in a way that the impeachment inquiry underway is really the weakest read that you could have going after Trump, where the really strong cases should be built around Russia, around criminality, and around treason?
Well, I agree with you. However, the Democrats and Speaker Pelosi, I think quite rightly, have found a very clear, perhaps understandable narrative in the Ukraine story relating to Trump's attempts to put the arm on the Ukraine president to assist in his 2020 campaign and to destroy politically Joe Biden. However, I think that Trump's attempts in that regard really pale to insignificance, as you suggested, given the fact that the CI, the counterintelligence investigation, most likely, from what I'm hearing, does confirm our suspicions that Trump is, for all intents and purposes, a Russian agent, and has acted consistently in a manner to aid and abet the archenemy of the U.S., namely Russia. That's treason. I think the Democrats and the country would be so shocked by a fulsome investigation of Mr. Trump's treason, so horrified that unfortunately it might paralyze the nation. So I think the Democrats, perhaps strategically and tactically, have come upon the Ukraine narrative as the most palatable and the most efficient way to proceed for impeachment. But as you indicated, it's really only the tip of the iceberg. It's just that to fully investigate the iceberg below the surface would take far more than a few weeks. And we're quickly approaching the 2020 investigation. So whatever Congress is going to do, they have to do it quickly.
Well, Ken McCallion, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks so much, Jan. I appreciate the opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Kenneth McCallion, a former Special Assistant Attorney General, who in his early career worked as a federal prosecutor in the Department of Justice, handling high-profile organized crime prosecutions, and worked on major labor racketeering cases, including some investigations that dealt with the construction of Trump Tower. He also worked on numerous sensitive counterintelligence investigations involving Russian espionage in the United States, involving coordination between and among U.S. Department of Justice and FBI agents with the CIA and the U.S. Department of State, and he's the author of the new book, Treason and Betrayal: The Rise and Fall of Individual One. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
War is not the answer. Politician and them bobo niggas. War is not the answer. I'm thinking over the solution. Rasta says, yeah. War is not the answer. We tell the politician and them start drop them bomb. War is not the answer. I'm thinking over the solution. Rasta says, yeah. War is not the.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute for Afghanistan Studies, and he's the co-author of Afghanistan, an Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, a Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you.
And hundreds of confidential interviews with key figures involved in prosecuting the longest war in, I think, in U.S. history, this 18-year-long war in Afghanistan, have finally revealed that the public has been constantly misled and that this war is unwinnable. No news to you or to me, for that matter, Tom. But what about the American people? I mean, this has kind of the whiff of the Pentagon Papers.
It would if Afghanistan were on the front burner of American politics as the Vietnam War was. One of the reasons that it's gone on so badly for so long, it's always played the stepbrother good war to the bad war in Iraq. So I would imagine if there's a secret war report on Iraq, it's probably worse. That doesn't help Afghanistan. But I think one of the things that came up in this report was that not only did people in Washington in the executive branch not want to hear bad news of the policies that they were putting forth, but Congress didn't want to hear it either. They kept allocating money, saying spend money, pushing for making democracy work, liberating women, making Afghanistan into a capitalist country, all kinds of things that were dubious propositions to begin with if you had a 3 to 5 year timeline. And so there weren't any committees in Congress holding investigations on Afghanistan. What was going on? Why were we going to do it? And because there were no real horrible defeats in Afghanistan, the way there were, for example, the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, the public wasn't suddenly shocked to realize, well, we've been told one thing, but something else is actually going on. In point of fact, I don't think many Americans actually believe that much good was happening there in the past 10 years. Maybe in the first 10 years they did, but not in the last 10.
Well, the report has been put together over a period of 3 years after a legal battle. They were collected for a lessons learned project by the Office of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. I guess the acronym is SIGAR. And it's a 2,000-page document. I think it was leaked to the Washington Post, and it certainly was published by the Washington Post.
I believe it was not leaked. They won a court case.
They won a court case, okay.
It's the Freedom of Information
request. Oh, it's a FOIA request. Okay.
Yep.
So, again, not new, but still incredibly damning. The war has cost $1 trillion, killed more than 2,300 U.S. servicemen and women, with more than 20,000 injured, and tens of thousands of Afghan civilians have died. I guess there's no casualty figures of the Taliban or of the so-called collateral damage of Afghan citizens. And the Taliban are continuing to kill innocent Afghans, as we've seen almost on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
But to my mind, Tom, one of the most damning quotes is from Douglas Lute. I think that's how you pronounce his name, L-U-T-E. A lieutenant general served in the White House as the czar of the Afghan war during all three presidents, Bush Jr., Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. And he said in 2015, quote, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing." Pretty amazing, coming from a senior military officer.
Yes, and not just a senior military officer, but one who had moved over in the political role in the White House. They were the ones that were setting this policy. And that is what is very troubling, is that at the highest levels, people sort of knew what a basic problem was, that how can you win a war that you've actually never defined what the war is about. In some ways, the great tragedy was that the United States won the war in less than 10 weeks in 2001. The Taliban were gone. And that was the time to do reconciliation and to put things together. And instead, quite a number of mistakes were made at that time, partially because the Bush administration wanted to go to Iraq, partially out of hubris about wanting to do more. But that essentially the goal of defeating al-Qaeda had been completed in 2001, and the United States refused to recognize that it had won a victory and move on to peace. Instead, it looked for a war, and it got one.
So going back to the quick victory against the Taliban, what was going on there? Does the report cover the debates one assumes were going on in the Bush administration? We know that Cheney and Rumsfeld and company desperately wanted a war with Iraq, and I believe at one point Rumsfeld said that there are no good targets in Afghanistan. So we know that that was going on.
They can't have a real war there. There's nothing to blow up.
That's for something along those lines, right?
Yes.
So, but were there people inside the administration saying, look, we've won, we don't want to occupy the place, you know, let's figure a way to get out?
Well, there were certainly people. The Bush administration, partially, was keen to get on to Iraq, but it had decided that what Afghanistan needed was a light footprint. But they misinterpreted what the situation was, and it was almost like a no footprint, because there were fewer than 14,000 foreign troops in the first and second year in Afghanistan. And the New York City Police Department is larger than that. Okay. They didn't have a policy, and in particular at the Bonn Accord, or even after, when they were doing the Loya Jirgas and setting up the government, quite a number of Taliban actually wanted to become part of the new government. They saw the Taliban was gone, time to get with something new. The U.S. absolutely rejected that. They said, no, these people can't participate. And in fact, they began attacking them. That drove many of them back into the idea of an insurgency if their life wasn't secure. We lost the opportunity that we could have gotten a surrender from the Taliban. Mullah Omar actually gave a surrender document to Hamid Karzai, and he gave it back. But many of the major groups in the Taliban were looking to pivot to say, well, can we play a part in this new government? The war's over. Something else is going to happen. And certainly the United States had experience from the Second World War. Is we had dealt with the Japanese. We had dealt with the Nazis. When the war is over, you need to pivot. into something else, not to keep looking for other enemies. And unfortunately, in Afghanistan, we left those people out, and then it was too late when we realized the mistake had been made to bring them back in. So we got a, it took 3 or 4 years for an insurgency to work its way up, but there it was. There were some people that raised that, but by and large, particularly once Bush had given his, you know, you're either with us or against us, that kind of policy does not work very well in Afghanistan. The people are with you or against us at any given time, but they're subject to change. This would have been the opportunity to make that change. It required more sophistication. And the Bush administration also thought, we'll just do nothing with Afghanistan, we'll go to Iraq. And unfortunately, Afghanistan is not the kind of place you can just sort of leave on the back burner and it'll sort of fix itself. So when you put those two things together, it created the conditions that then allowed sort of what had been actually a real victory to turn into what's now the longest running war in American history.
But after the Taliban were routed and after Tora Bora, when they blew up a lot of the Taliban, but bin Laden did escape into Pakistan, isn't that where the real issue lies, Pakistan?
The Pakistani American military has always said, and the Afghans have pushed this, the people you are looking for are in Pakistan. They left. And Pakistan has been the major supporter of the Taliban insurgency. One can't fight an insurgency when the insurgents have sort of a safe house next door and a funder. You can defeat them on the battlefield, but you're not going to get rid of them. And the United States never put the pressure on Pakistan that needed to be done. And Pakistan was always of the opinion that the U.S. would eventually leave, get bored, and therefore they should bank on trying to bring the Taliban back. To some ways, it's a misguided policy because Pakistan, by focusing on this, actually created the Pakistani Taliban. There were probably more people that were killed by suicide bombers in Pakistan than there were in Afghanistan. There's been a huge amount of blowback for Pakistan. It's hardly been a successful policy. And it's not clear because even when the Pakistanis supported the Taliban were not very cooperative in terms of their interest. Allies in Afghanistan are always very difficult to turn into clients, and that's what Pakistan was looking to do.
Well, given that this sort of new iteration of the Pentagon Papers basically shows this very clear and sustained effort by the U.S. government to mislead the public and, you know, distorting statistics, et cetera, and keep saying that we're winning, we're making progress, when the opposite was true. Let's discuss what could have been done after 18 years and $1 trillion of going nowhere, and Trump wants to pull out preemptively, from what I understand. Afghanistan's always been a rentier country, hasn't it? It doesn't pay its way. So that's one issue. And two, just given what you just told us about Pakistan's agenda, they would have come back one way or the other to destabilize the place. So what could have been done after the light footprint? What do you think George W. should have done then?
I believe he should have brought in essentially the Taliban, who realized they were defeated and had not really bought into the Taliban ideology. And were looking to cooperate with the new guy, and quite a number of them were. They were actually discussing how could we approach, you know, the new government. What's the role for us? And that essentially was forestalled in part because some of our allies took the opportunity to grab power by just claiming these guys were terrorists and saying you should shoot them and not negotiate with them. And our people had not only a minimal knowledge of Afghanistan, but a minimal knowledge about sort of how Afghans did politics. We were looking for parties and manifestos and clear lines, and it's not a place where you find it. So there was an opportunity. The first 2 or 3 years, and when I was there at that time, you could travel anywhere in the country practically. There were no police, there were no military, but there was no real violence either. There was this lull, this window of opportunity. And the Loya Jirga that they held, which had representatives from all over the country, the UN recruited people to take part in that with meetings all over the country, and there was no real violence to take place. Afghans at that point were really looking to turn a corner. They had already suffered a million dead and 4 or 5 million refugees with the Soviet war. So then they had had the civil war in the 1990s. They were looking for a real change. And we could have bought into that. You know, and it didn't have to be American troops. Before the U.S. invaded Iraq, we had all the NATO countries behind us, including Turkey. We could have asked the Turks to send 20,000 troops, put 5,000 in each city, so they would be NATO troops, but they'd be NATO Muslim troops, Sunni Muslim troops, to kind of show this isn't an infidel invasion. This is your Turks, which you have had good relationships with over a century or more, here to not to maintain order, but to prevent trouble from coming back. There were a number of things that could have been done because the world was very open to the United States before it invaded Iraq. It could have gotten a lot of help. After it invaded Iraq, people continued to help us in Afghanistan, but rather grudgingly.
And during the Obama administration, what did you make of efforts to work with Iran? Obviously, the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal, was a part of that. But my understanding is that the Iranians, with money and help from India, have built a road from the Indian Ocean port all the way up to Herat in the Shia section of Afghanistan. And the idea then was, because Afghanistan is a landlocked country and we've always relied on the Pakistanis to get supplies in, and they've occasionally extorted us, or if not always extorted us in terms of getting the trucks, etc., through the Khyber Pass, etc., and it's been held up a few times. So they've had a lot of leverage over the U.S. by being controlling the only supply route, and come out with an alternative supply route that would have been good, not just to end the war effort, but also to give the U.S. another card to play, but it would also be good for the Afghan people. What happened to that initiative?
Well, the road is still there. That's still a possibility. The problem is that, and this is true even of the Obama administration, that anything that had Iran in it was never seen as cooperative. We were working with them, you know, or the Obama administration was, to try to control their nuclear program. But even with George W. Bush, the Iranians have been actually quite supportive of the American intervention, surprisingly so. But, you know, within a few weeks of the war ending, Bush throws Iran, North Korea, as part of the axis of evil. So the Iranians would actually, at least on Afghanistan, in other areas, they had their own interest. You know, if we're talking Iraq, Syria, other places, Lebanon. But in Afghanistan, actually, Iranian and American interests dovetailed in part because neither of them wanted to see a radical Sunni insurgency like the Taliban. That's a threat to Shia Iran. But also Iran saw economic possibilities of with road connections through to Central Asia. So there were a number of things that essentially building up the economy, building up these links, would have helped Afghanistan economically. But it's also true to the extent that trade began going through Iran to the Persian Gulf. This reduced Pakistan's leverage on Afghanistan because up until that point, anything coming by sea had to go through the port of Karachi. And Pakistan had a stranglehold on goods coming in and out of Afghanistan. This, for the first time, really in history, Afghanistan had an alternative, you know, another sea route in via Iran. So there was some potential leverage there. But it's if anything, it wasn't so much hostility to Iran, but it just the idea. Anything in Iran was a non-starter. Because Iran was sort of poisonous in American politics, so nobody really wanted to explain why we could do business with Iran on Afghanistan, but not elsewhere.
Well, now the tables have turned, though, in terms of the Taliban having leverage. Just after the U.S. defeated them, we had the leverage. We spurned that opportunity. Mm-hmm. Now
they are just killing people all over the place, destabilizing the place. It's not even clear that the Taliban people that we've been negotiating with are actually speak for the Taliban. The whole thing looks like a complete disaster. And I could understand why, if Trump decides to preemptively pull out, you know, most of the American people will just say good riddance.
The American people will say good riddance until something really bad comes out of Afghanistan, and then they'll blame every politician who caused that to happen. We pulled out of Afghanistan during the 1990s when it was in civil war, and our thinking was, what do we need places like Afghanistan for? The Soviet Union has collapsed. It's a new world. Let the Afghans kill each other. And then we got 9/11. We got Al-Qaeda, and people said, how could we have neglected places like Afghanistan to become havens for terrorists? The great irony is that if you do an immediate pullout, the one agreement, that strategic goal that the Americans had going in Afghanistan was to make sure that Afghanistan never became a haven for terrorists again, could actually come about. Because I can tell you, the first thing Pakistan will attempt to do if we pull out is to move all the terrorists out of Pakistan back into Afghanistan. They can then declare themselves terrorist free and let them go about their work across the border. And anything that happens in Europe, the United States, because of that, then look at the troubles that we've been having with the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. I think that's given a number of administrations real pause. Do you really want to take that kind of chance? Because Americans are likely to be very unforgiving, more unforgiving than sort of lies about, well, things are going well when they really aren't. As more unforgiving to any politician that it looks like allowed something horrible to happen when they could have prevented it. That's, I think, there's in a lot of politicians' minds. There's Afghanistan, to some extent, the money we're putting into it, there's only, what, 12,000 American troops there. They see it as an insurance policy. They're not putting a lot in, but most of the lives that are being lost are Afghans, which for Afghans is certainly a tragic situation, but for American politicians is less so.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield. He's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, and his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night. The headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.